You've probably heard it said that if you're going to study the scriptures, you need to study them in their historical context. What that means is that the scriptures were not written in a vacuum. There was real world people writing to real world persons or audiences in a context, in a cultural context. And if we're really going to understand what this speaker was saying to this audience when they wrote these letters and wrote these books, we need to understand some of that historical context, because it will make a difference in what the words mean, the issues that are being dealt with, and how they're dealing with them. That's what we're going to spend a lot of time doing today, is looking at some of that historical context that surrounds the New Testament period, particularly as we look at Acts 21 through 28 today. We're going to look at that as we go through, some of that historical context that brings it alive a little bit and helps us understand what Luke, the author, was communicating, but also to understand a little bit more about the historical context for the rest of the New Testament as we cover that in this series. So if you have your Bibles, open them up to Acts chapter 21, and that's where we're going to begin, and we're going to finish out the book of Acts today in our time together. As we come to Acts chapter 21, there is a context. In fact, there is a clash of two cultures that are going on in Acts 21 through 28, as it has been going on all the way through the books of the New Testament. From the very beginning, when Christ was born, there was this clash of two cultures that was going on. And as we finish the book of Acts, we see that clash is still going on all the way through the book of Revelation in the New Testament. That clash is going on. That clash is between these two cultures of Israel, the Jewish nation, but it was part of the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was another culture altogether. And as we have gone through the book of Acts, we saw that in the first seven chapters, there was a focus on what was going on in Israel and the birth of the church there in Jerusalem, and then in Judea and Samaria in chapters 8 through 11. But when we get to chapter 12, the focus goes totally away from Israel for the most part and is focused on the other parts of the Roman Empire. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Now, when we talk about what was going, those clash of two cultures, what were some of the roots of that? When we look at in Israel and Jerusalem during the time of the New Testament, much of the culture of Israel was shaped in great part by a man named Herod the Great. Herod the Great built the Temple Mount and made the temple in Jerusalem the showcase of not only Jerusalem, but all of Israel. He built several fortresses at Masada, the Herodian. He built cities in other parts of the empire as well, but most of his work was done there in Israel as the king of the Jewish nation. He was made king by Augustus, the Roman emperor. He gave him that title and gave him that role and responsibility. One of the things that Herod did was build a brand new city called Caesarea. It was a northwestern part of the nation port on the Mediterranean Sea. It was not a natural port. He built the port out into the sea, and he made it the headquarters for the Roman Empire in all of Israel, all of that Middle Eastern area, in fact. It became the headquarters. It was the largest city in Israel, but Herod's influence continued to spread down through the generations through the rest of the New Testament, and we'll see that a little bit as we go through this today. The other side of the coin, when we look at the Roman Empire, much of the Roman Empire culture that we're going to see throughout the New Testament was in great measure shaped by Augustus. The Caesar. He was actually, his name was Octavian, but the Senate gave him the name the August One, Augustus Caesar, because he was the first Caesar that had been there in a long time and that would be there for a long time after, who was in favor of all the people. The people liked him, the Senate liked him, the army liked him, everybody liked Augustus. And he did some phenomenal things in the empire. He did a lot of things to create infrastructure that took a collapsing empire that had been in civil war for the last 14, 15 years, and he revitalized it and shaped it for the next 200 to 300 years. He did many things, built a highway all the way around the Mediterranean Sea. He made travel on the Mediterranean Sea safe for the first time in human history. No more piracy. He made it possible to travel from country to country around the Mediterranean, which is what the Roman Empire was, basically, all the countries around the Mediterranean Sea. He made travel from country to country easy, enjoyable. The major thing that he did, though, that affects a lot of the New Testament is he instituted what was known as the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. It was peace that he said, we're going to have peace, even if it takes an iron fist to enforce it. And that's what it did. He said, we're going to have peace at all costs, whatever it takes, no mercy. He instituted that. And it provided a lot of freedoms and opportunities for citizens of Rome, people who were legally citizens of Rome. They had lots of rights and responsibilities. They could travel freely. They didn't have to fear the government. They didn't have to fear the army. They had a lot of privileges, and we're going to see some of that come into play as we go through Acts 21 to 28. Some of the ramifications of that Pax Romana, that Roman peace that Augustus instituted. So as we come to Acts chapter 21 with a little bit of that in mind, and we'll flush that out a little bit more as we go through these chapters, what's happening is Paul has left Ephesus, where he had been for 3 years on his third missionary journey. He has traveled back down through Macedonia and Achaia, through Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea and Corinth, and collected an offering that he could take back to Jerusalem at the end of this trip to help out the destitute people, Christians, there in Jerusalem. Some of those Christians stayed in Jerusalem in spite of the intense persecution, but things were very hard for them. So he wanted to collect an offering. He did that, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. He stopped in Corinth and spent the winter there, that last stop on the way, and he not only collected an offering from them, but he wrote a little book while he was there, a book to a group of Christians in Rome called the Book of Romans, and we'll look at that next week. But in chapter 21 now, he's on his way to Jerusalem after finishing up all of that, taking this offering to them, and he hits the port cities, east part of the Mediterranean, and coming down to Caesarea, that city, that port city that Herod the Great had built. And every place he stops, the Christians there tell him, don't go to Jerusalem. Bad things are going to happen in Jerusalem. And Paul already knew that. In chapter 20, he tells us, I know there are going to be harsh things that happen there. But he tells them here, I'm prepared to not only suffer, but to die, because I believe this is what God wants me to do. He wants me to go to Jerusalem. Now, why would it be so fraught with danger for him to go to Jerusalem? Remember, the last time he was in Jerusalem living there, he was a person who was on the Jewish leadership side working against Christians. And to them, he became a traitor. He became someone who betrayed them because he not only abandoned that cause of trying to track down and arrest Christians, but he became one and became a major spokesman for them. And so to go back now, he's going back as one considered a traitor, one who is considered a leader who is leading people out of Judaism into this, what they considered a cult that was started there in Jerusalem. And they were trying to get rid of that. As he arrives in verse 17 in Jerusalem, finally, walking from Caesarea down to Jerusalem, he meets with the Christians who are there. He gives them their gift. They're excited to see him. He meets with James, the leader, James, the half-brother of Jesus, who wrote the little book of James that we looked at, and the elders of the church. He meets with them, and they tell him, listen, you have a bad reputation here among the Jewish population. It's going to be very dangerous. And they recommended to him to go through a purification process, which is a week-long process that involves shaving your head, going into the temple area every day and going through a purification process to show the Jewish people, look, I'm Jewish and I'm still practicing many of the Jewish customs, at least this one. He does that, but in verse 27 of chapter 21, we see that when the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, Ephesus is in Asia, back where he had been for the last 3 years, these Jews from there who were there in Jerusalem now, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd, and they laid hands on him. And it goes on to tell us, they laid hands on him, they call others to join them, and what they're trying to do is get a mob together and kill him. Let's get him out of the temple area. So they drag him out of the temple area, and there is this mob forming, and it's getting louder and louder. And what happens is the commander there overseeing the troops in Jerusalem, his fortress, Antonio's fortress, is right there in the temple court area, in the court of the Gentiles, right on the corner of it. And it's a tower that goes up, these steps go up in this large tower, and there were approximately 200 soldiers that lived in that tower. They could see most of Jerusalem. They could see all the temple court area. And there was a mob forming right at the base of where their fortress was at. The commander comes down because there had been riots in other parts of Israel. In fact, just within a few months before this, 2,000 Jewish people were killed by Roman soldiers because of the riots in Caesarea. And he doesn't want to get into the problem of that here. So he rushes down with some soldiers, sees that Paul is the focal of attention, pulls him out there in chapter 21. And he starts taking him up the stairs. Paul says, "Hey, wait, can I talk to my brothers for just a minute?" He's safe. He's in custody of the soldiers up the stairs. The mob's down below. Maybe this will help. So the commander says, okay. So chapter 22, most of it is Paul addressing the Jewish mob that's trying to kill him. And he does it in Hebrew. Commander doesn't understand a word, but he starts speaking to this crowd in Hebrew. And it says, there is a hush. Commander likes that. He doesn't know what he's saying, but there's a hush that comes over the crowd. And Paul begins to speak to them. And what he's doing is telling them a story. In the first five verses of chapter 22, he's reiterating, "Don't you remember when I was among you and the things I did here? Don't you remember how I was looking for Christians just like you are and trying to get rid of them? But then you sent me up to Damascus, and on the way, there was a bright light," and he goes on and he says, he tells them his story of how he met Jesus and the difference Jesus has made in his life. He's just telling his story to a spellbound group of Jewish people in Hebrew, telling them this. And that goes very well until he gets to verse 21, and he's telling them part of what Jesus told him to do. "And he," Jesus, "said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" And at that point, there is the riot all over again. They go absolutely wild. Gentiles, those clash of cultures. The Jewish people hated the Gentiles. They not only disliked them, they saw them as the enemy of God, the enemy of them as a people. And they hated them. And the Gentiles returned the favor. They hated the Jews because they were so uppity. They thought they had the only way to God. They said there was only one God. And Roman culture said there were many gods and we need to worship them all and not show favoritism to any of them. And we need to not leave any of them out and not do anything to tick them off. And the Jews, to them, were ticking off the other gods because they claimed none of them other gods were real, just their God. And so there was this clash, and they, no way in their mind, the Jewish mind, could God, the Messiah, be sending a Jew to Gentiles. There was no way that they could understand that. And that clash of culture shows up once again. And with that, the Roman commander takes him up into the fortress, spreads him out, gets him ready to be whipped. He says, I'm gonna beat him and interrogate him until I find out what's going on here and why he's such a troublemaker. And as he's stretching Paul out, as one of the centurions, a leader over 100 soldiers, is stretching him out, getting ready to beat him, Paul just happens to say, "By the way, has the law changed? Has the Pax Romana changed? Or is it okay to beat and interrogate a Roman citizen without a fair trial?" He says, "You're a Roman citizen," and he runs to the commander, scared to death. The commander comes to him, scared to death. And he says, "Are you a Roman citizen?" He says, "I am." The commander says, "Look, I worked hard for my citizenship. I paid for it. over time. Paul says, yeah, but I was born a citizen, which was even considered an elite form of citizen in the Roman Empire. And he is scared to death. Why? Because of the Pax Romana. The Pax Romana said, you are protected as a citizen, even from the army, even from an official of any kind within the Roman Empire. They cannot do anything to you without a fair trial. And if they do, their head's on the line. So this commander is scared to death. The centurion is scared to death because they have broken the Pax Romana. They've broken the Roman peace law. And they're afraid that Paul's going to turn them in some form or fashion. What he does the next day, he says, look, I want to settle this. I don't want any more riots. That looks bad on my record. So in chapter 23, he brings him down the next morning to the Jewish leadership there in the court of the Gentiles, the part of the Temple Mount. He brings him down there, and he's hoping that they'll be able to work this out, talk this through without the mob. But Paul realizes very quickly they're not there to discuss anything. They're only there to condemn. And so he quickly brings up a theological issue, the resurrection of the dead. He says, I believe in that as a Pharisee. And the Pharisee said, so do we, and the Sadducees, we don't. And they turned away from Paul and started arguing with each other. And once again, the centurion had to pull him away and take him up into Antonia's fortress. Paul's nephew gets wind of a conspiracy that is taking place. We see this later on in chapter 23, of 40 men who make a vow, 40 Jewish men who had been a part of that mob, we will not eat or drink until we see Paul dead. We're going to assassinate him. And so the Jewish council said to the commander of the Roman forces, look, bring him down again and we'll talk this time. We'll have a discussion. But it was a trap. Paul's nephew hears all of that, goes and tells Paul. Paul tells him, go tell the commander. And the commander takes Paul, and to protect him, to eliminate any problems, he sends him with 270 soldiers in the middle of the night up to Caesarea, the capital that Herod the Great had built, that great port city where the governor of the whole region, the Roman governor who oversaw that whole region, lived and where he served. And he sends him to the governor to go through a trial up there. And what we see in chapters 24 and 25 into chapter 26 are the trials that take place there in Caesarea. There's actually one major trial, but then there are a number of times that Paul is brought back to speak to Felix, the governor. And he speaks to him very clearly. And Felix is not very easy to get along with. Nothing is settled at that trial. But in verse 24, it says this, but some days later after the trial, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. So he brings Paul in with his wife. I just want to hear you talk some more. He's fascinated by this guy, Paul. He was a great orator in his self-defense that he had, and he wants to hear more about this. In verse 25, it says, but as Paul was discussing righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away, no more. And he keeps him locked up in jail there, in the fortress there for 2 years, hoping, continually bringing him back, talking to him some more a little bit, and sending him away. Hoping, though, that eventually Paul will give in and offer a bribe to be released. But that doesn't happen. Felix is removed from his responsibility and replaced with Festus, the new governor. So Paul's there for 2 years under Felix. And then Festus comes into play, and he sees Paul there. He goes to Jerusalem in chapter 25, and hears this story about Paul from the Jewish leadership, goes back to Caesarea, his capital city, his home now, and he says, bring this Paul to me. I want to know what's going on. And he says to Paul, somewhat innocently, because he doesn't know any of the history, how about if I take you down to Jerusalem and we have the trial there? Well, Paul knew what that meant. It meant the conspiracy would be reinvigorated again, and he would be killed during that trial down there. And he says in verse 11, Paul says to him in verse 11, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything wrong worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Part of the Pax Romana was that you could, if you did not feel like as a citizen you were getting a fair trial, you could appeal to Caesar and you could go basically to our Supreme Court automatically. And so Festus had no alternative but to, because he was a citizen, Paul was a citizen, he appealed to Caesar, he didn't feel like he was getting a fair trial. Festus says, okay, I'm going to make preparations and send you to Rome, and you're going to stand before Nero, the new Caesar who is there. And you're going to have to plead your case to him. And that's what Paul had asked for. So Festus agrees to do that. However, before he has a chance to actually send him, something else happens. Herod Agrippa, we're told there in chapter 25, Herod Agrippa, the king, the new king, the great grandson of Herod the Great, who is now the king of that area, the highest civil authority in that area, he comes down to Jerusalem, and Festus says, welcome. By the way, I've got this case, and I'd welcome your Jewish background to help me know what to do, because I've got to send this guy Paul to Nero in Rome, and I've got to send a letter explaining what the case is, what the issues are for this trial, and I really don't understand all this Jewish mumbo-jumbo that they're talking about. It doesn't make any sense to me. Could you listen to him and give me some idea? And so Paul has the opportunity in chapter 26 to speak to King Agrippa, who's Jewish in his background, but he's in place as king of Jerusalem, of Israel, under the authority of the king of Rome, the Caesar. So he serves under the new Caesar Nero. And so Paul makes his case before him. It's interesting how Paul makes these defenses, because in one case it says he raised his arm and began to speak. You see, Paul was trained in both of these cultures we're talking about. He was trained in the Jewish culture, brought up and taught from birth in the Jewish culture, but his teacher was Gamaliel, who also taught Platonic philosophy and speech, how to give orations and speeches and how to do that. And so Paul was able to make his own defenses. So he stood up and raised his arm as a good Gentile would do, a good Greek orator would do, and begins to defend himself. And the governors and the king are fascinated by this guy who is so diverse, so easily walking between both of these cultures. And he begins speaking to Agrippa, and he tells his story again. It's interesting to me, when Paul is sharing the gospel, he does it in the form of sharing his story. Too often we think, I've got to have my facts down if I'm going to share the gospel with someone. I've got to have the four laws, or I've got to have something that's going to be a tricky little thing to help me get through and give people the verses and all that. You know, when Paul shared the gospel with people, it was in the form of sharing his story. He did that before with Felix. He's doing it now with Agrippa, sharing his story. What went on in his life? He did it with the Jewish leadership, with the Jewish mob before. That's what he did there, was share his story. Can we do that? We get so intimidated by sharing the gospel with someone. Ooh, evangelism, that sounds so threatening. All it is sharing your story with other people. I had the opportunity a few weeks ago, I was out playing golf. I went out there to play by myself, and I got out there and a guy joined me I'd never met before, and we played two or three holes, and he asked me that invariable question that one guy will ask another when they meet each other, what do you do? And I told him, I'm a pastor. Usually when I tell people I'm a pastor, in a context like that, it gets very quiet. There's not a whole lot of conversation after that. Usually there will be a change in their the way they talk or act or do things after that. But this guy was a little different. He said, really, I don't know that I've ever talked with a pastor personally before. What made you want to become a pastor? And I just thought to myself, what an opening, what an opportunity to tell my story. So I said to him, just in a few sentences, I said, you know what? When I started college, I was a pre-med major, and I'd planned since I was 9 years old to be a doctor. But it was at that time that I came into a understanding of who Jesus was, that he wasn't, that he was real, and that he wasn't just a man, he was God. And I researched it and I studied it, and I was convinced Jesus truly is who he said he is, the one who has come to offer us hope and freedom in this world, to come and deal with my sin, because I realized I was messed up. And I realized that, and he came to offer me forgiveness of my sin and offer me a new kind of life on the inside that would begin. And I received that gift that he offered to me of forgiveness and a new life, and entered into a relationship with him. And from that point forward, he's been changing my life in all kinds of ways I can't tell you. Few sentences, few things we talked about. Just told him in a nutshell my story. Now, it got a little quiet after that for a while. We didn't talk anymore about that for a while. But later on, he asked me a few more questions, and we were able to talk a little bit further. But I just shared my story. I'm not responsible for how he responded. I'm just responsible for sharing my story of how I came into a relationship with Jesus Christ and the difference it's made in my life. I can do that. You can do that. Any of us can do that. Don't get threatened by having to memorize a whole bunch of stuff. Just talk about your story. Share your story with other people when you have that opportunity. And that's what Paul does with Agrippa. He shares his story. When we come to verse 26, he starts speaking directly to the king and addressing him, not just sharing a story, but starts addressing him, bringing it down to, what are you going to do with this? In verse 26 of chapter 26, Paul says, "For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice. For this has not been done in a corner, in secret." You've seen a lot of the events that have taken place. You've seen the spread of Christianity in your kingdom here in Israel. You've seen that over the last several years. You've seen the impact of it. King Agrippa, in verse 27, "Do you believe the prophets? I know that you do." And Agrippa replied to him, "In a short time you will persuade me to become a Christian." What Agrippa is saying is, you've put me in a corner. I'm either going to have to respond like a fool, or I'm going to have to respond honestly and say, you know what? Everything you say is true, therefore I need to be a Christian. And he feels that box, and he says, "You're putting me in this corner," and he says, "Send him away. I don't want to hear anymore." He didn't want to hear the truth anymore, even though he recognized it as truth. Paul was not responsible for Herod Agrippa's response. He was only responsible for sharing with him his story of how he came to know Jesus and the difference Jesus made in his life. And then Agrippa tells Festus, the governor, in private, he says, "You know what? If he hadn't appealed to Caesar, we would have let him go today. We would have freed him today." But that was not God's plan. God wanted Paul, and Paul knew that, to go to Rome. And that's what we see in chapter 27. They put him on a ship along with the people who had been with him, including Luke, who writes this book of Acts. Luke was there this entire time. As you follow through the book of Acts, on that last journey when he goes through Philippi to collect the offering, Luke goes with him to Israel, and he stays there with him the entire 2+ years that Paul is there. Where do you think Luke, the Gentile, the Greek, not Jew, got all of his information about the life of Christ to write the Gospel of Luke? He was in Israel with firsthand people who lived there, the apostles, possibly Jesus's mother, Mary, brothers and sisters, James, his half-brother. He could get the life of Christ there while he was, from firsthand sources. Where do you think he learned about the early chapters of Acts? He got firsthand accounts from the apostles who were there as he interviewed them and talked to them and researched with them. And Luke, along with Paul and others, other prisoners, are sent on a ship, a small ship that followed the coastline of Asia, we see in chapter 27. Then they're picked up by a bigger ship, a much larger ship, that took them, and they had all kinds of trouble. This trip, which should have taken a few weeks, took probably at least 6 months for them to finally get to Rome because of weather issues, shipwreck issues, getting stranded on an island. It's a very interesting chapter as you go through chapter 27, seeing all the problems they have. When you come to chapter 28, the last chapter, in verse 16, he says, when we entered Rome, he finally gets to Rome. They enter into Rome. It says, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who was guarding him. Paul was put in his own private quarters, his own little house, but there was a Praetorian guard who stood outside of the door and checked anybody who went in and anybody that came out. If Paul wanted to go somewhere in the city, he could. He just had to be chained to the Praetorian guard and go around the city with him. Now, when Paul writes his little letter from Rome to the church at Philippi, he makes this comment in the first chapter. They think I'm their prisoner, but really the Praetorian guards are my prisoner because they don't realize every place I go, they have to listen to my story over and over again. They're my prisoner, Paul said. I'm not theirs in many ways. But he stayed there, as we see at the very end of the chapter, 2 years. This is really the fourth missionary journey of Paul paid for by the Roman Empire. His trip was paid for, his accommodations were paid for, his safety was paid for through the Praetorian guards. Everything was paid for by the Roman Empire for this fourth trip. And we're told that people came in daily and he was teaching them in his little home daily throughout that two-year period. The first thing that Paul does when he gets to Rome in verse 17, he says, after 3 days, Paul called together all those who were the leading men of the Jews, not the Christians, but the Jews. He calls in the leadership of the Jewish community who had been back in Rome for about 6 years. Claudius, the emperor before Nero, had kicked all of the Jews out of Rome in 49 AD, in 49 AD. Because they were having this ongoing argument, causing a lot of trouble, these discussions about Christus, which means the Christ. There were some of them who had become Christians and some not, and they were debating among themselves, and there was a lot of turmoil within the Jewish community, and the emperor, Claudius, says, get out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Get out of Rome. And they left Rome. Many of them left Italy altogether and went other places in the Roman Empire, and they had to flee for their lives at that point. Just get out of here. When Nero took power in 54, he allowed them five years later, he allowed them to come back in. And so now then they're in this little commune across the river in their own little village, separated from all of the Gentile Romans. They're over there on the other side of the river. And Paul calls for their leadership and says, I want to speak to you. And he talks with them. He shares his story about Jesus. And they begin to debate and argue and question and discuss, and all of this is going on. And it says, slowly but surely, some believed and some stopped coming altogether eventually because they didn't believe. But that became part of the basis then of people who were coming to his house daily to be taught. What he says to these Jews before the last ones leave, though, who are not willing to believe, he quotes from Isaiah chapter 6 in verse 27. I'll pick up there. It says, for the heart of the people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes. Your hearts have become dull. Quoting their own prophet Isaiah, hearts have become dull. You don't hear, you don't listen, you don't see what you don't want to see anymore. Just like Herod Agrippa, I don't want to hear anymore. He said, and that's true about you. You're not coming back anymore, you don't want to hear anymore. One of my concerns is, how are we doing? Are we a people who are becoming dull of heart? Do we get used to the sameness of we're coming to a service on a weekly basis? In a life group. We hear this over and over again. We hear this book taught every week. We need to be careful that we don't become dull of heart. Can I encourage you, if you find yourself getting ho-hum about this book, you're getting ho-hum about the truth of God for mankind. Can I encourage you, ask God, God, revitalize my heart. Help me to listen with real vitality to the word when it's taught. Help me to do that. Paul was such a proponent of that. As I studied through the book of Acts years ago, I noticed something very interesting. In Jerusalem, when the church was first formed, there were some problems that arose in chapter 6 and early chapter 7, and the apostles make this statement. Look, that's an important issue. It needs to be dealt with in the church, but we are not willing to give up praying as apostles and teaching the word. We also saw that the people were devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching daily on a regular basis. That was one of the things they were devoting themselves to. Was Jerusalem was a teaching center, a place where people could go and hear the truth of God. When we go to chapter 12 in the book of Acts, the focus changes from Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria up to southern Turkey, south central Turkey, to Antioch. And there we see the focus is on this group of teachers who are teaching regularly these new believers there in Antioch. And Barnabas is one of them. Paul is brought in to help with that from his hometown of Tarsus, a few miles away. And they are teaching. It's while these teachers are gathered together, praying together, that the Spirit says, send apart Paul and Barnabas. And they go on these missionary trips. On Paul's second missionary trip, he stops in Corinth and spends 2 years there, year and a half to 2 years in Corinth, teaching daily. Corinth becomes a teaching center. Just like Jerusalem and Antioch, now Corinth. On the third missionary journey, he spends 3 years in Ephesus teaching daily in the hall of Tyrannus. Ephesus became a teaching center. Israel had a teaching center. Central Turkey had a teaching center. Western Turkey had a teaching center. Now into Europe, Greece had a teaching center. And now then what we see is that Rome becomes a teaching center for Paul. For 2 years, he's teaching daily people in his home. Paul and the apostles felt like the teaching of the word on a regular, consistent basis is so important. I was in a church a number of years ago, that I was sitting in a meeting with a bunch of other pastors, and one of the pastors said, you know what, people don't need to hear the Bible anymore. They just need to go do what they already know. And I sat there, understanding where he was coming from a little bit, but just angry inside. I said to myself, that's like someone looking at their gas tank and saying, it says full, I just filled the tank with gas. I don't never need to fill the tank with gas again. I just need to drive the car. Well, what's going to happen when you drive the car 300 miles, 400 miles? You run out of gas, and you got to put gas in the car. We are not made to be people who can just live indefinitely with a little bite here and a little bite there, or we studied it at one point in our past, or we know a lot about the Bible. This book is for daily feeding. This, we need it. We live in a culture that is so inundated with falsity presented as truth. And we need something to change our perspectives, help us see through those mistruths that are being presented to us on a regular basis. Those lies, we need to be able to see through it. And this book is so important. It discourages me. It disheartens me when I realize statistically, we as a congregation of adults, we attend every second or third Sunday on average. You know what? It's not about numbers, and it's not about you being here and us being here. It's about this. We need this on a regular basis. And the teaching of the word is such an important thing. We need to, we ought to cherish that opportunity and make every opportunity to be here to hear the word taught. That's so important. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. You have given us a precious, precious gift. Help us not to become dull of heart. Help us not to take what you have given us for granted. Help us to cherish this gift and look for every opportunity to hear it taught, to be students of it, and to hear others who have studied to teach as well. Help us to do that, God, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.